10, 9, ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Lift off. Welcome to the Alien Probe Podcast. It is Sunday, March 31st, 2024.
Easter Sunday.
This is how we roll.
Yeah, it's our Easter.
You know, and we're going to be doing the 1955 Flying Saucers Have Landed by George Adamski and Desmond Leslie. We're on this is our episode 7, and we're on chapter 9. We've done 6. You know you're excited.
This gets a lot of listens.
I'm surprised.
Me too.
We've got George's picture up there on the screen. We're just because of the current condition of UFO and NHI situation where we're trying to get disclosure. This is kind of a history of leading up to where we are today, and this is in the 50s, so it's pretty interesting. I mean, not everybody's going to like it, but it's I kind of like to show people how we got to this point. George Adamski certainly was a pretty important figure back then. He was very involved in the situation. So we're going to start out with chapter 9, Saucers in the Sanskrit. Make sure I started this thing. It would be so comforting if we could dismiss all the accounts of fable, but the farther we go into the ancient works, the more accounts we come across of aeroforms, power sources, and super weapons, which mean little to the Sanskrit translators of the 19th century, but have a very ominous and significant meaning to us today. This is George writing, I should say. This is George Adamski writing with Desmond Leslie.
He writes very pretty and fancy in one long sentence.
And it doesn't like scientists too much, but obviously. You know, let me reset you up here. Oops.
Oh no.
It ruined everything.
Oh, Lord.
I lost George. Okay, go ahead.
All right, I am not trying to prove that the pre-Diluvians had atom bombs or something similar. I shall be quite content if I can show that they knew how to build a type of flying saucer. But I would like to quote a few passages from the Mahabharata, written over 3,000 years ago, which shows conclusively that certain tremendous cosmic forces and their manipulation were not unknown to them.
I quote these not as an interesting digression, but merely to show that if a perished civilization once understood the workings of nuclear energy, as well as a type of radiant energy still unknown to us, then there is all the more reason to believe the reports that they also had flying machines of amazing power and ability.
The first excerpt is an eyewitness account of the weapon called the Agnaya, I think it sounds like angina, upon an unfortunate angina. Army below. Generals might do well to study it. A blazing missile possessed of the radiance of smokeless fire was discharged. A thick gloom suddenly encompassed the host. All points of the compass were suddenly enveloped in darkness.
Evil-bearing winds began to blow. Clouds roared into the higher air, showering blood. The very elements seemed confused. The sun appeared to spin round. The world scorched by the heat of that weapon seemed to be in a fever.
Elephants, scorched by the energy of that weapon, ran in terror. You should not scare the elephants.
No.
Seeking protection from its terrible force. The very water being heated. The creatures who lived in the water seemed to burn. The enemy fell like trees that are burned down in a raging fire. Huge elephants, burned by that weapon, fell all around. Others, scorched, ran hither and thither and roared around fearfully in the midst of the blazing forest.
The steeds and the chariots, burned by the energy of that weapon, resemble the stumps of trees that have been consumed in a forest conflagration. Thousands of chariots fell down on all sides. Darkness then hid the entire army.
Cool winds began to blow. All points of the compass became clear and bright. Then we beheld a wonderful sight. That's a poem right there.
Oh, wow.
Burned up by the terrible power of that weapon, the forms of the slain could not even be distinguished. We have never before heard nor seen the like of that weapon. That's from P. Chandra Roy, 1889, in the Drona Parva. The good old Drona Parva.
This terrible description of chariots charred to stumps like burned trees, and thousands of men so burned that not even their shapes could be distinguished, was possibly first written 10,000 years before Nagasaki. In the Masala Parva, there is a weapon likened to an iron bolt through which all members of the race Vrishnis and Adakas became consumed into ashes.
Indeed, for their destruction, Kanra produced a fierce iron thunderbolt that looked like a gigantic messenger of death. So dreadful was this weapon.
It's pretty dreadful, isn't it?
I can't speak. You're going to have to speak.
You all right? In great distress in the mind, the king caused the bolt to be reduced to a fine powder. Even then, it still possessed some dreadful, virulent power, for which he employed men to cast that power into the sea. That's more P. Chandra Roy from 1889, the Drona Parva.
2 years.
Yeah. But with all these precautions, a great deal of damage was done by some invisible, or radioactive means. People's hair and fingernails fell overnight.
Ooh.
Gales blew all day. Pottery cracked, so no apparent cause. Birds turned white, and their legs became scarlet and blistered, and food went bad within a few hours.
Oh, not the food.
Yeah.
Sorry, I think
some go down the wrong pipe?
No, I've been out walking the dog, and I think the allergies may have
kicked in. Oh, they're kicked in. Man.
And that's...
Tis the season.
I just went completely dry there. Okay. Besides the Agnaya weapon, there is a Brahma weapon, like the bull, which was said to contain the powers of the god himself that not even the immortals could withstand. This weapon is interesting, for it is like nothing known today. None of these are like anything known today.
Well, it's close to... Similarly, the first description was like a nuclear bomb, but this is more akin to specific weapons such as, hypersonic missiles and things. Also referred to as Indra's dart, it is operated by a circular reflecting mechanism. It is not fired, but turned on like a searchlight. Immediately a glow comes out from the mechanism, a shaft of light, growing steadily stronger until the target has been completely consumed. The power is considerable, for on a perfectly fine day, it immediately causes a great disturbance in nature.
Winds blow, water boils, animals run amok. The only thing that can counteract it is another Brahma weapon. Two of these, operating in opposition, completely neutralize one another, which strongly suggests that they worked on a vibrationary principle, which could be neutralized by carefully turning opposing waves. Wow.
The restrictions given against the indiscriminate use of these weapons are many. They may never be employed except in dire emergency, when all other weapons have been tried and failed. They may not be used against civilians, nor against soldiers in retreat. Well, I have some strong rules. If anybody follows those.
Well, I mean, if somebody's running away, you don't just shoot them in the back.
Yeah, that's true.
Drona is roundly admonished for breaking these rules and told that he will have his power withdrawn if he ever does it again. Thou hast, with the Brahma weapon, burnt the men of earth who are unacquainted with arms. Civilians.
Oh, wow.
This act is not righteous. do thou not again perpetrate such a sinful act. I'm back into the drone apartment there.
Well, you look at the date, 1889. I mean, we didn't have anything like this. Well, and again, they're discussing 1889, but it's 10,000 years ago or something. You know, it's a long time ago. Before using the Brahma weapons, the operator invariably touches water, which to us would imply the making of an electrical contact or a good earthling. The effects are described in many places. Drona's son touched the water and discharged the Narayana. Violent winds began to blow. Showers of rain fell.
Peals of thunder were heard, although the sky was cloudless. Earth shook. The sea swelled up in their confusion. Nobody likes a confused sea. Mountain summit split. Darkness set in. The Brahma weapon afflicted Partha and all beings. Earth with her mountains trembled. Terrible winds began to blow. The sea swelled in agitation. It's funny how they just capitalize random words.
In the rout following the desolation, a curious thing happens. Among the stampeding, screaming elephants, runaway chariots, and blazing desolation, the fleeing soldiers rush off to the nearest water, where they strip and wash themselves and their arms, while the rout is still in progress. Now, why should they have to stop and have a bath and wash their armor in water? Never very good for it in the best of times. At a moment like this, unless they were frightened of being contaminated by something, unless some peculiar quality had been imparted by their armor in the blast that they knew would be fatal unless swiftly counteracted, kind of like, what, radiation.
Right, which water does not cure. We are told that only those wearing metal or grasping metal objects will be hurt by the Brahma weapon. Those who throw down their arms and leave their chariots will not be slain by it. But those who even think to contend against it shall be slain, even though they hide deep in the earth.
So they it knows. It knows who's a soldier, who's a civilian, who's running, who isn't. It's discriminant, huh? The importance of avoiding metal when the weapon is active is frequently stressed. In one battle, Bhimasena is narrowly rescued from certain death by being dragged from the chariot at the last moment. So they can't touch metal. That's interesting. So that implies a form of electricity, you would think.
It does touch. Well, what, can you go up a little bit?
Yeah.
Importance of avoiding. Okay, I got you. Okay. Enveloped by the weapon of Drona's son, Bhima, with his steeds, driver, and chariot, became incapable of being gazed upon. Like a fire of blazing flames in the midst of another fire, all the fierce rays began to proceed towards Bhima's chariot.
As the yuga fire consuming the universe comes at last and enters the mouth of the Creator, so the weapon began to enter the body of Bhima. The blast of the superweapons was many times brighter than the sun.
To describe it adequately, the ancient writers frequently make comparison to ultimate dissolution of our solar system when the sun suddenly flares up into a supernova, expands and devours the planets one by one. A tenet recently involved by modern science but frequently mentioned in the ancient books, where the example is Arjuna burned all the Kurus by the heat of his weapons like the sun that appears at the end of the yuga, consuming all creatures. This kind of reminds me of the Star Trek where they only talked in metaphors. You know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The original Star Trek. I remember. Well, it says 432,000 solar years ago. I think that's interesting.
That's a while.
Seeing this, Krishna and Arjuna shout to him to throw down his arms and get away from the chariot as quick as he can. Bhima, overwhelmed by the blazing electrical fire, stands in a daze, muttering abuse at the enemy. What would they be saying, Deb? What do you think, Deb? What are they saying?
Hatred people. Whereupon his two friends, who have already taken protective measures, jump down from their own cars and run across to him, shading their eyes from the glare, while that weapon of Drona's son directed against Bhima increased in energy and power.
Oh, wow. Grabbing him by the arms, they drag him from the platform, throw him to the ground, and quickly disarm him, whereupon the weapon is quieted and the winds cease, and the blue sky is seen again. But Bhima is furious, and he feels he has suffered an ignominious defeat in the eyes of the enemy. It's kind of like
poor Bhima.
And the Day the Earth Stood Still, the original, and I don't remember if the new one did this, because that was Keanu Reeves, and that was kind of, you know. That was another thing. If you didn't have a weapon, they
would not attack you.
Yeah.
Poor Bhima. He's very upset. At the next encounter, the two sides are more evenly matched. Bhima, on his chariot, rushes to attack and once again becomes the target for the blinding rays of the super weapon. This time, it is neutralized.
Beholding Bhima overwhelmed by that weapon, Dhyaya neutralized its energy by covering it with the Varuna weapon. None could see that he had thus been covered by the Varuna weapon, owing to the fiery force that enveloped him. So he has his own weapon. So he's got the Varuna.
Yeah, sure. The weapon. This movie has lost me. The weapon of Drona's son began to enter the body of Bhima. As one cannot perceive a fire if it penetrates into the sun, nor the sun if it penetrates into a fire, even so, none could perceive the energy that penetrated into Bhima's body. As in an earlier combat, when Partha counteracted Drona with his Brahma weapon, so now all agitation in nature was speedily pacified. It seems like they're same neutralizes.
Yeah, they've got kind of similar weapons, which is mutually assured destruction.
Everybody's dead.
So far, the flying saucers have been singularly peaceful. In all the centuries they have been in our skies, I have been unable to find a single case of hostile action. The prehistoric Earth-made saucer, or Vimana, was, however, a formidable weapon in war. Let me give you a few instances of how they were used to attack cities and armies, and of the appalling destruction that resulted.
Kukra, riding in that excellent Vimana, which was powered by celestial forces, proceeded for the destruction of the Triple City. For this particular operation, it had been decided previously to build a Vimana of great power.
The city is so strong that only a weapon that can destroy its three sections at once is deemed practical. These three parts are to be pierced by one missile. By no other means can their destruction be effected. I wonder if they actually use the term missile in that.
First of all, a general bombardment takes place. Kukra, surrounded by the Maruts, began hurling his thunder upon the Triple City from all sides. Then the terrible one missile is used. He flings a missile, which contained the power of the universe, at the Triple City. The city began to burn. Smoke, looking like 10,000 suns, blazed up in splendor.
The Triple City, is that one with that? Is that Atlantis? Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. So terrible is this weapon that even the gods are afraid. Seeing the powers of the universe united in one place, the gods became filled with wonder. In fact, they have to intervene and extinguish the fire, saying, do not burn the whole world to ashes.
Don't burn everything. God.
Dang.
People, I do not wish to confuse the issues at this point. I really don't. For we are trying to confine.
It's too late.
We are trying to confine the subject more or less to the Viminas, you know, the Viminas.
Yes, the Viminas.
But in 1945, did not the American government succeed in producing a weapon that also contained the basic power of the universe? Viminas were also used against armies.
Yes, like Oppenheimer. A huge and terrible Vimana made of black iron. It was 400 Johannas high and as many wide, equipped with engines set in their proper places. No steeds nor elephants propelled it. Instead, it was driven by machines that looked like the size of elephants. An eyewitness on the ground tells of air bombardment of his army by the Rashakas.
We beheld in the sky what appeared to us to be a mass of scarlet cloud resembling the fierce flames of blazing fire. From this mass, many blazing missiles flashed, and tremendous roars, like the noise of 1,000 drums beaten at once. And from it fell many weapons winged with gold, and thousands of thunderbolts with loud explosions and many hundreds of fiery wheels. It's like a great fireworks show.
Yeah, and it's like, is that like flying saucers or mm-hmm. what are the flying wheels? Fiery wheels.
Fiery wheels.
Loud became the uproar of falling horses slain by these missiles and of mighty elephants struck by the explosions. With cries of, oh, and alas.
Alas.
The wandering army seemed on the point of being annihilated. Those terrible Rakshakas had the shape of large mounds stationed in the sky. Another Parva thing.
All would have been lost had not Kama produced a secret weapon which knocked the Rakshakas' bombing fleet out of the sky. Karna took up that terrible weapon, the tongue of the destroyer, the sister of death. A terrible and effulgent weapon. When the Rakshakas saw that excellent and blazing weapon pointed up at them, they were afraid.
They don't want to be. They don't want any of that. They don't want any part of that.
No.
The resplendent missile soared aloft into the night sky and entered the star-like formation, and reduced to ashes the Rakshakas' vimana. The enemy craft fell from the sky with a terrible noise. Even while falling to earth out of control, one of the vengeful Rakshakas was determined to do as much damage as possible, so he adopted the recent Japanese technique of kamikaze and crashed his monstrous machine into the troops below so that a part of the army were crushed and pressed into the earth.
That sounds wow. nasty.
You know, that's not...
This is very violent.
I know.
Recall
wild.
The shape of large mounds stationed in the sky. Like a mass of azure cloud in the sky, surrounded by a rainbow. Viminas, decked and equipped according to rule, looked like heavenly structures in the sky. Borne away, they looked like highly beautiful flights of birds. They were not all built in the original, more efficient circular shape. The Ramayana describes aerial cars of changing whim and fashion, shaped like horses, eagles, and elephants. There's a lot of talk of elephants
They're getting pretty fancy now. Wow. But again, it is possible that these were merely the names given to different sizes or classes of viminas. Just as we give our own aerial cars names like hornet, moth, dragon, dragonfly, albatross, moth, gull, etc. after whatever bird or animal that takes the maker's fancy.
The Puspaka vimina. The Puspaka. Was possibly of the elephant class with its furnishing, windows, mini apartments, and ability to carry all the veneras as well as Rama, Sita, and Lakshmana.
All of those.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. We get occasionally stories of giant viminas which seem to devour of Deva. In the Mahabharata, when the Asura Maya sets out in a huge, gorgeous, golden circular construction with four power plants and a circumference of 12,000 cubits.
The cubits.
About four times the size of the monster that destroyed Captain Mantell's fighter plane over Godman Field in, you know, more present day. Couldn't the same be said for flying saucers? And the word of the day, Deb, is?
The got. Gacharachaka Babadma. That's not what it says, but that's what I'm calling it.
Gato Trakata Badma. Yeah, close.
Makes a statement that is even more startling. Gifted with great energy, the Rakasha once more came down to earth in its golden vimana. When it had landed, it looked like a beautifully shaped mound of antimony on the surface of the ground. In the recent film, The Day the Earth Stood Still, a clever representation was given of a flying saucer landing in a Washington public park. It sat there on the grass, a shapely silvery mound of gleaming metal, for which I can think of no better description than a beautifully shaped mound of antimony on the surface of the ground.
We move into chapter 10, Saucers for a Song.
For a song.
And they say that, you know, if one of the things that is said... You know, it's theorized is that people that are into music see flying saucers and, you know, things, there's strange things flying around more than people that aren't musical like you and I. That's probably why we don't see anything.
Left brain versus right brain.
Is that it? Because Matt's seen stuff and I'm like, I haven't seen anything. No matter how many Vimanas come to light from Hindu Brahmin in Sanskrit and Pali literature, the secret of the power that moved them silently or musically or with a mighty roar is still denied us.
Where we can search, or where can we search for a force that will carry a great aerial construction, immense distances, and to vast heights without the use of fuel? Who ever heard of getting something for nothing, of power without loss or expenditure?
Until a few months ago, such a thought, and bear in mind this is 1955.
A few years ago. A few decades ago.
Such a thought was against all the known laws of energy and its conservation, and any physicist would have told you politely and firmly that this was impossible. Just as an eminent professor once told Edison, when treated to the actual demonstration of the first talking machine, the learned professor was deeply offended and insisted that Edison was employing some kind of ventriloquist deceit, for everyone knew that sound could not be conserved. Certainly not a little wax cylinders, not little wax cylinders. You know, Edison tried to sell the patent to the telephone for like,
yeah, we saw that yesterday.
Was that $20,000?
Yeah, that was yesterday. Yeah.
Western Union.
Yeah, Western Union didn't want it because they wanted to.
I thought I'd mention that. Yeah. You know, they didn't think it was a good investment.
The professor was proved wrong, and his spiritual heirs are now undergoing the same salutary experience since they have got into the higher realms of nuclear physics, where certain work, particularly that concerned with the hydrogen bomb, entails the actual creation of matter from energy.
The laws concerning the conservation of energy are now undergoing a substantial modification, but it will probably not be until about 1986 before their full significance is understood. But oddly enough, the mysterious force made a brief reappearance in New York, of all places, during the 1890s.
Overlooked in all the bustle and bustle with which progress is progressing on its way, a lonely inventor named John Worrell Keeley of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, rediscovered this lost power, and gave it the name Dynospheric Force. Sounds like a band.
I know, huh? Keeley's experiments aroused considerable interest at the time, and the wealthy Barnato brothers sent their representatives, Ricardo and Seaver.
No, just Ricardo Seaver.
Oh, Ricardo Seaver.
Don't take away his
credit.
We
sent their brothers, so, you know, okay.
No, the Barnato brothers sent their representative.
Across the Atlantic to investigate his work.
This was long before anyone had produced a television set, discovered cosmic rays, or thought about conditions existing above the then current fourth state of matter.
Keeley stated that while investigating the magnetic forces flowing between the Earth's two poles, he had discovered the corpuscles of matter could be divided by vibration 42, and that he could apply this principle to drive a motor.
Wow. For his demonstration to Seaver, Keeley stood at one end of his New York laboratory. The motor was mounted at the other. Then he played a certain note on a violin, whereupon the 25-horsepower motor began to turn, gaining speed until it practically jumped in its mountings.
Well, that's pretty incredible. It ran at this high speed, during which time the inventor did nothing more. Eventually, to stop it, he again took the violin and played a discord, whereupon the force seemed to be withdrawn, and the motor came to a stop.
Wow. The surprised visitor was then invited to try to start the machine himself using the same violin. At first, he was unsuccessful, but when Keeley touched him, he was able to start and stop the engine.
Ooh. Interesting. Notice the similar idea behind Keeley's word corpuscles of matter could be divided by vibration and the modern discoveries that atoms can be smashed by ultra-high frequencies. We are dealing with a lower order of energy, but the new concept is in accord with Keeley's postulation.
Ooh, big word. Why should this be? From the surviving Keeley papers, we read concerning a later motor. At one time, the shareholders of the Keeley Motor Company put a man in his workshop for the express purpose of discovering his secret.
After 6 months of close watching, He said to J.W. Keeley one day, "I know how it is done now." They had been setting the machine up together, and Keeley had been manipulating the stop cock, which turned the force on and off. "Try it then," was the answer. The man turned the cock, and nothing happened.
"Oh, no. Let me see you do it again." "Do it again," the man said to Keeley.
I should have gave you that burger.
The latter complied, and the machinery operated at once. Again, the other tried, but without success. Then Keeley put his hand on his shoulder and told him to try once more. He did so with the result of an instantaneous production of current. What is this Keeley dude?
We see he's an inventor. We see then that in order to produce the required vibration, Keeley's personal vibration was needed.
It's a very personal vibration.
The one problem which he never succeeded in solving was to produce a machine which would operate without the personal vibration or willpower of the operator. Yeah, and that's the thing that is coming up for April with us. We've got a guy that, you know, it's that your mind can actually produce this power. You know, that we have this inside of us.
We have power.
Come on, Deb. You know you have it in you.
Commenting on this, the author of The Secret Doctrine says, "It is just because Keeley's discovery would lead to knowledge of one of the most occult secrets, a secret which can never be allowed to fall into the hands of the masses, that failure to push his discovery to his logical conclusions seems certain to occultists. The results obtained from the fifth and sixth planes of the etheric or astral force will never be permitted to serve for purposes of commerce and traffic."
Yeah, they don't want that to get out there. The secret doctrine goes on to confirm what I already guessed. An easy guess. If the question is asked why Mr. Keeley was not allowed to pass a certain limit, the answer is easy. It was because what he had discovered was the terrible sidereal force known to and named by the Atlanteans, Mashmak, and by the Aryan Rishish in their Astravidya by a name that we do not care to give.
Oh, so we just don't get to know what it is.
Well, they just said, no, we're not going to tell you.
Okay. It is the Vrit of Bulwer.
Oh,
Bulwer.
Oh, he told us.
Bulwer Lytton's coming race and of the coming races of our mankind. The name Vril may be a fiction. The force itself is a fact, since it is mentioned in all the secret books. The Secret Doctrine, Volume 2, Adyar Edition. That's my favorite edition
Is that your favorite one?
It is this vibratory force which, when aimed at an army from an Agnaritha, that's a fire chariot, fixed on a flying vessel, according to the instructions found in the Astravidya, would reduce to ashes 100,000 men and elements as easily as it could a dead rat.
Wow.
I know.
That's something. It is allegorized. I like allegorized better. Allegorized in the Vishnu Purana, in the Ramayana, and other works, in the fables about the sage Kapila, whose glance made a mountain of ashes of King Sagara's 60,000 sons.
Wow, he gets around.
S-O-N-S. And which is explained in the esoteric works and referred to as the Kapila Kasha and Kapila's Eye.
You know, anybody who knows this stuff must just...
They're going to be like, oh my God, you guys are butchering
it. If you guys had read it ahead of time and Google one word at least, jeez.
Yeah, I'd go with that. I could Google a couple of them.
And is it this satanic force which, once in the hands of some modern Attila, would in a few days reduce Europe to its primitive...
That wasn't even one of those words.
I can't even say normal words now. Primitive chaotic state with no man left alive to tell the tale. Is it this force which is to become the common property of all men alike? That's from the Secret Doctrine.
Volume 2.
Volume 2.
The answer to this question asked about 80 years ago seems to be yes. But before we are all reduced to ashes, let us take a look at Keeley's next experiment, Deb.
He made a model metal airship. Model metal.
Hell yeah.
Weighing about 81 pounds.
And 8 pounds.
Oh,
I did the same thing. And I was like, 81 pounds?
81 pounds, that's big. 8 pounds, and attached it to a thin platinum wire. The other end of the wire was joined to his sympathetic transformer. And again applied the mysterious sonic principle. By this, he was able to make the airship rise in the air, hover, descend, and move about at will.
Only because of his vibrational power. His personal vibrational power. Okay. Now compare 12 August 1950. The scene is the little mountain village of Campello, near the St. Gothard Pass in Switzerland. Many people, including a professor of physics, reported 80 to 100 flying saucers passing overhead.
God, wouldn't you have liked to have been there?
Hell yeah.
As they passed, they made a noise like an organ, said the professor. Others described it as the sound of a tremendous chord of music, a celestial symphony, melodious sound as it coursed along its airy way.
And on 22 May 1947, clusters of flying saucers shot across Denmark at treetop height, making a deep, tuneful humming sound like huge bees or like vacuum cleaners, said a mechanically minded Dane.
Dane. A vimana can be moved by tunes and rhythms. That's Samar. By music alone, some were propelled. That's from the Book of Ohapsby. People did not walk up and down stairs in the very old days, say the legends of the Caribbees. They hit a plate and made a song, and the song said where they wanted to go, and so they went.
They just saw it in their mind.
Just sang a song.
Anybody could dance in the air like leaves in a storm. Everything was so light. At this juncture, Professor A.C. B. Lovell of Manchester University springs to Menzel's defense. That's from the Listener of 2 July 53, pointing out that meteors sometimes make a drumming or buzzing noise at the point of fall.
Possibly they do, but the subject in question happens to be not drumming or buzzing meteors, but musically inclined flying saucers. Not one of these noisy saucers has fallen to the ground, even though, in some cases, it has passed within a few feet of witnesses' housetops. Nor have meteors been found within hundreds of miles after such occurrences.
With a little encouragement, I may be able to help Professor Lovell prove that London buses are only ionized pockets of air, reflecting through temperature inversions the red neon signs of Piccadilly Circus, for which I should doubtless receive an emeritus chair.
Whoa.
Got that?
I got that. Mm. According to the folklore of Galway, Ireland. God, what is wrong with me today?
We started too late again.
I know.
anything afternoon is not, I shouldn't as, good, have, not I as good quality
I
production.
I shouldn't have had a phone conversation on my walk. I wore out all my words. I should have just listened. According to the folklore of Galway, Ireland, on the opposite side of the Atlantic, in the old days, everybody danced in the air like leaves in the autumn wind. People made a song to a plate. And from St. Vincent Island in the West Indies comes this legend. The wise people of old could fly quite easily. They had no wings. They clapped on golden plates, made music on them, and flew. I set on my foot.
That's from Wilkins, The Secret Cities of South America. Mm. Among the gifts which Montezuma, the last Aztec emperor, gave to Cortez, who nobly rewarded him with torture and death, were two large flat gold discs. That's nice. Flat gold discs about the size of gramophone records. These were said to be emblems of royalty and were intended for King Charles V of Spain and his queen.
The king's disc was about a quarter of an inch thick. The queen's was much thinner.
That's a big disc.
The queen's was much thinner.
She's not as strong.
Montezuma.
She's got that pencil neck to get hold of.
Montezuma knew what the discs were for. But it seems that Cortez looked upon them as very clumsy and heavy things to wear. and it is doubtful if he ever reached Spain, for they are not listed in any of the treasure ship's inventories.
These discs were cut to a size and thickness exactly corresponding to the size of the person for whom they are intended. They had to be of the correct size so as to suit the wavelengths of his personal vibrations. Thus, the owner alone could use them.
Keeley's machine only worked when he was present and consciously directing his vibrations towards them. Evidently, the Spanish king never received or ever tried out his flying discs. Had he done so, there would surely be a minute in the most holy records of the Inquisition lamenting the fact that His Majesty, on striking a vile heathen symbol, was seized by Satan and cast up into the air.
Where is the connection with flying saucers, Deb?
I was going to ask that, too.
I do not yet know. I see only fragments divided by time and space, yet strangely alike. It is as if a jigsaw had been scattered over a field.
There is no immediate connection, and yet there is a unity to all the pieces. The Aztec discs were carefully measured to fit their user. Could the great secret of scientific levitation have been preserved up to the 16th century as the royal prerogative of the Incas? Is it still preserved? Is it?
Somewhere secretly handed down from generation to generation, under fearful vows lest it fall into the hands of the white destroyer?
Oh, the car celestial uttered a melodious humming sound. Built by people more civilized than the Aztecs, it might have utilized an extension of the same principle.
Perhaps in its two stories and many chambers, it contained multiple batteries of discs or a single huge resonant plate, which, when harmonized to the vibrations of the pilot, would raise not just a single man, but a whole great machine.
What about the dark and light metals that fell on Marv Island?
Maury.
Oh, that's not a V?
No, because there's a...
Oh, okay.
There's a correction line under
it. Okay. Take another look.
I know the story. That's okay. The only reason.
Take another look at Keeley's engine. He struck a note and the engine ran until stopped by a discord. He struck another and a model airship rose from the ground.
Whether sound was used to give Elliot's ethic force its first impulse, or whether it was a mental radiation from the pilot, the idea is the same, a vibration.
Sonic and mental waves are both vibrations. Just as the soundless waves entering a radio produce a physical sound in a lower plane and octave.
The science of harmonics and their application as a source of power was well understood until disaster overtook civilization and the great mother country sank into the abyss of destruction, spreading her surviving children to Brazil, Yucatan, and Peru on one side, and to Egypt and India and Chaldea on the other.
The Drona Parva gives a beautiful, though veiled, description of how sound, tuned to the will of the operators, provided the motive power of the Kukra Vimana, one of the greatest ever built.
We shall build a Vimana of great power. The mind became the ground which supported the Vimana. Speech became the tracks on which it was to proceed.
All speeches and scientists were gathered together within it. All hymns and the Vedic sound, I don't know, Ash At also, I'm not sure what that is. And the syllable Om placed before the car made it exceedingly beautiful. When it set out, its roar filled all points of the compass.
This needs a little analysis, Deb.
Thank God.
Mental powers harmonized to certain magnetic forces provide the lift. Graduated harmonics guided it on the desired path. The whole of the ancient sciences known at the time had been employed to produce this masterpiece of celestial navigation.
The Vedic word of power, Vashat, is used to indicate and emphasize the use of harmonics. The Hindu word of power, Om, the fifth syllable of the ineffable name, is also given to show how perfectly the whole project was attuned to the natural cosmic forces that made it exceedingly beautiful.
I have other records on my files of flying saucers that produced a strange musical note described by observers as unlike any sound they have ever heard. For example, at 5:50 p.m. on 27 September 1952, George H. Williamson of Prescott, Arizona, heard and saw a colossal saucer pass over his house with a noise he described as different and more powerful than a jet. Musical, rather like a swarm of bees.
The colossal forces, latent in properly regulated vibrations, have long been suspected by modern science. And I believe I am right in saying that amazing discoveries have recently been made along those lines, which may soon completely revolutionize our world for better or for worse.
But what happens to Keeley?
Whatever happened to Keeley?
Were you wondering about what happened to Keeley? His invention was in advance of the time. He died poverty-stricken. It's a familiar story, like Tesla. And broken.
Broken-hearted.
In his disillusion, he destroyed his models and most of his papers. Well, he had to just destroy all the evidence so nobody gets it.
Nobody has it. If I don't make a money, nobody makes it. Only a few pamphlets published by his patron, Mrs. Bloomfield Moore, remained to prove that he, or disneferic force, ever made a brief reappearance on this planet.
I believe that this force, or something very similar, was discovered again by Lester Henderson of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in 1928, who produced a motor said to derive its energy purely from the Earth's magnetic field. Henderson made a small model powerful enough to light two 110-volt lamps.
Such an outrageous flouting of orthodox proprieties brought swift retribution in the form of Herr Doktor Hochstetter, the principal of a research laboratory of the same name in Pittsburgh, who went to pains to expose Henderson as a wicked, irreverent fraud. Wow.
The Herr Doktor, so that pure science might shine forth untarnished, went to the expense of hiring a lecture platform from whence to denounce Henderson and all his books. By demonstrating an exact model of the motor, which, as was to be expected, failed to work.
Hochstetter fumed that some years earlier, Henderson had hidden a tiny battery in the motor. Some years earlier. Quite how this was supposed to have run 210-volt lamps, he didn't say. Henderson admitted the battery as being a blind to lead inquisitive snoopers off the scent before he had patented his process.
The good doctor also failed to notice that Henderson at the time was in hospital recovering from a 2,000-volt shock, which had suddenly blasted out of his motor during a demonstration. But as is usually the way with these things, Hochstetler succeeded with his public damnation, and Henderson, discouraged, faded into obscurity.
Well, I guess if this Earth vibration is going to, you know, produce enough to, you know, put you in the hospital, it probably isn't that reliable. Meanwhile, we struggle bravely with almost insurmountable problems of building a rocket large enough to contain fuel with a sufficient exhaust velocity to lift a machine out of the Earth's gravity.
Tons and tons of expensive fuel, which blows out of 7 miles per second. Out at 7 miles per second would be required, and millions of pounds would have to be spent on research and complicated equipment, and all so that some other unfortunate planet may enjoy the blessings of earthly ways and earthly politics, may become a bone of contention, a kind of cosmic Korea to be fought over by the two opposing halves of our ant heap, Deb.
Ooh, our ant heap. How funny if all along the answer could have been bought literally for a song. That's deep.
All right, that's the end of chapter 10 of Flying Saucers Have Landed.
Wow.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of the Alien Probe Podcast. We welcome questions, comments, or requests to alienprobepodcast@gmail.com. Visit us on Facebook. Check out our website at alienprobe.net. Twitter and Instagram at alienprobepod. Rumble and YouTube, like and subscribe. Thanks, Deb. Appreciate
you
joining me again for...
That was fun.
Good old Flying Saucers Have Landed. And we'll see you next time. Watch the skies.